Hey everybody, it's Brock Falk, and I want to thank you for listening to this message from Heritage Church of Christ. We would be thrilled to share more content like this with you and make it easy for you to share it with others. You can find more messages like this on our podcast, or you can download our smartphone app by searching for Heritage Church of Christ in your app store. But most importantly, I hope this message encourages you to take a next step toward a thriving relationship with Jesus. Enjoy.
I can remember when I was 16 years old, actually when I was 15, and they, for some reason, didn't really check ID, I got a job at Target. And my favorite thing about my job at Target that I thought, you know, the job was otherwise kind of mundane, but my favorite thing was once in a while, I would get to take empty cardboard boxes and go use this incredibly, like, enormous and incredible cardboard eating machine called the compactor and baler, okay? Like, it was this thing that I was just astounded by the power of this machine and how it would crush all of this, like, seemingly huge pile of cardboard into this little cube, you know, for it to be shipped off. And then when I figured out later that OSHA really doesn't approve of 16-year-olds running that machine, then it was a lot more exciting to me that I was getting to do that. And it was fun to me that they had trained me to use that. And so then I used it every chance I got. You know, I thought it was like so cool. And some of you can remember what on-the-job training feels like, especially at the beginning of a new position. And there are all kinds of different orientations and trainings that happen when you start at a new job. Sometimes the training is just about procedures and protocols. They're showing you how to use the copier and where the coffee machine is and where the time clock is and things like that. But sometimes some jobs require training that are all about safety and preventing serious injury. I mean, it's the kind of thing where life and limb are really on the line and you got to pay attention, you know, when you're talking about working in the kinds of jobs that require you to handle dangerous materials or to use powerful tools or to work in environments that create an element of risk. And as you can imagine, sometimes training and orientation is just not enough. Take, for example, these two construction workers here. You know, sometimes you get in a hurry. Sometimes, you know, when work just has to get done, it's tempting to ignore important safety rules. But I'm sure it was obvious to you the first time you saw it that the guy on the left is wearing hearing protection and the guy on the right is not, you know. And, man, I'm worried about his ears, you know. I mean, this could really be a problem. Or think about, how about the example of this factory worker who was asked to hang this sign on the wall, and he could have gone and found a ladder. He could have found a lift to be able to get him up to work at height. He could have worn a hard hat and he could have worn a harness, and that all probably would have been safer. But when the boss says it's time to hang the safety first sign, I mean, ain't nobody got time to go finding a ladder, you know? And so you stand on the tilted rails of the stairway, and then this next one's my favorite because you know that law enforcement officers go through extensive training on safely handling firearms, but sometimes you just need a place to sit. You know? And you would think that all of the problems in these pictures would be pretty obvious to these guys. And by the way, did you notice it's all guys? In every picture, it's guys, you know, that are getting into this kind of trouble. But you would think that the kind of trouble, the kind of problem that's so obvious to us in all of these pictures would also be obvious to these guys on the job. You would think that at a moment like that, their training would kick in and alarms would start to trigger in their minds and they would think to themselves, you know, there's bound to be a safer way to do this. But like happens too often, they forgot. All four of these guys forgot the most basic safety rules of using their tools on the job. And if these four guys survived the work days from the pictures that I just showed you, I really hope that they received some more training, some corrective orientation on how to do that job in the future. Now, you and I don't always think of our spiritual life this way. We don't always think about it as if there's a lot of danger to it. But the reality, and part of what I've been communicating in this series of messages, is that Christians frequently utilize a tool that can be pretty dangerous in the wrong hands and pretty risky without proper training. In fact, one of the reminders that I've shared in this sermon series that we're continuing today is that the Bible is a tool that has affected a lot of good throughout the centuries, but it has also caused considerable harm thanks to people who misused it. The Bible, of course, has been used to teach millions of people about the unimaginable love of Jesus Christ, but the Bible has also been used to perpetuate hatred and violence and injustice in entirely too many cases. This tool can be used for good, but it can also cause harm when it's used improperly, which is why in this series of messages this month, we've been going through a little bit of Bible orientation together. And this is our fourth week of training. And in this series, we've learned to start thinking of the Bible not as a book, but instead as a library. And this is why we have these bookcases up here on the stage, for us to be able to visualize this together. To think of the Bible as a library instead of the book, because it includes such a wide variety of writings from so many different authors. And we've talked about in this series how the nature of communication and the ancient origin of the Bible demand that we interpret what we're reading in order to understand it in our modern context. And last week I argued that the key that allows us to make sense of the Bible's variety and even the Bible's discrepancies is Jesus. The life and teachings and death and resurrection of Jesus are the filter through which we should read all of the rest of the Bible. Now, for some of you, this series of lessons, this content, this may be the first time that you've ever considered or heard anything about the basics of the Bible. And I'm thrilled that you're along for the ride. For others of you, much of this is information that you've known for a while. Maybe you've been a Bible student for years now, and a lot of the information that I've shared is stuff that you already knew. But whether this information is orientation course or refresher course for you, today we're going to continue our training by addressing one of the most common mistakes that Christians often make in their attempt to apply the Bible's teaching. The mistake we're going to talk about today is a mistake I've made. It's a mistake I've made personally. It's a mistake that I've made and then learned to correct and then gone back and made again. In fact, the mistake we're going to talk about today is a mistake that I was taught to make, primarily because of the type of church in which I was raised. Now, you already know as you drove up here today that the name of this church is Heritage Church of Christ. For some of you, that doesn't mean much other than that we're a Christian church. For others of you, the words Church of Christ are part of what brought you here in the first place. And if that's you, perhaps your spiritual background is a little bit like mine. I was born and brought up in this network of churches called Churches of Christ. And along the way, through my formative developmental years, I absorbed a lot of what I thought that meant. But it wasn't until I started studying church history in college that I began to understand the origins of the church that shaped my faith. Now, there's no possible way that I could adequately convey to you the entire history of this church movement in this sermon. But because I've done some of the study and because I've read some of the hundreds of year old documents from people who were part of this movement in its early days, I'm going to give you a quick few bullet points. You should know that the churches of Christ sprouted about 200 years ago from an American frontier movement that was trying to unify Christians who had become disconnected from each other because of arguments about theology and division between the churches, factions in the global church. You should know that the movement that sprouted Churches of Christ tried to repair divisions between Jesus followers by pointing to the Bible as the one common guide that we could all agree on to use to inform our faith. The dream, the vision, the hope of the movement was to undo centuries worth of human disagreement by trying to restore the simplicity of the original church from 2,000 years ago. And so the members of that church movement in the early 1800s on the American frontier walked away from the churches that they belonged to previously, which had their own distinctive theological positions and strict guidelines for membership. And these innovators, these pioneers, declared themselves to simply be members of the body of Christ at large. We want to be Christians only, they said. And so with their Bibles in hand, they started to attempt a practice of faith entirely based on how they saw the Christians in the Bible practice faith. They searched the Bible, scoured the Bible to find instructions, and they tried to apply those instructions. But there were some problems along the way. First, they figured out that the Bible contains a lot of instructions that apply specifically to Jews, but don't apply to Christians. For example, over here on this side, this Old Testament portion of your Bible, it required the Jews to travel to Jerusalem for worship. It required and prescribed animal sacrifice as part of their worship ritual. And so these pioneers on the American frontier shifted their attention to focus, to find the answers to their questions about how to live and do church today. They shifted their focus to the New Testament portion of the Bible. But they ran into some problems. You see, they realized that before he died, Jesus lived his life under Jewish law. And so these books, these blue books up here, that tell the story of the life of Jesus prior to his death, prior to his burial and resurrection, and really in total contain less than 5 chapters about the post-resurrection Jesus. They figured out that Christians were not intended to do everything that Jesus did, because everything changed when Jesus died and rose again. And so these pioneers in the 1800s on the American frontier narrowed their focus even more. They reasoned that if you wanted to know how to do church, you ought to study the parts of the Bible that contain church examples. And so they shifted their attention, not just to the entire New Testament, but to a subset, the book of Acts and the epistles and Revelation. They didn't forget about the rest of it, but they focused on this portion of the scripture as the part that would be relevant for them in their day and age. And it wasn't as simple as just reading the instructions and applying them. And by now in this series, you may be able to recognize why. It's because none of these books in the New Testament were written as instruction manuals. That's just not the genre of writing that we find here. It starts with one book that's a book of history, a 30-year retelling of the earliest days of Christianity. But The book is short enough that it really doesn't go into very extensive detail. In fact, it covers 30 years of history in about the same number of words that I'll speak to you in this sermon series. 30 years squeezed in to that number of words. And then that history book in our table of contents, which is not in chronological order, by the way, that history book is followed by an entire section of letters that claim to be written by the Apostle Paul. We think that's true about most of them. The first 9 of the books in our library from Paul were written to churches in Asia and Europe, in cities that were vastly different from one another. And then there are 4 at the end of that series of letters that are written to individuals. Timothy and Titus, Onesimus. But all 13, all of those letters, they're circumstantial. They were written to specific people to address specific questions with a specific agenda. In fact, these letters sometimes give different answers to the same question. And then down here, there's this bottom shelf. And on the bottom shelf, we've got first one really long sermon. I mean, the kind of sermon you'd never sit there long enough for me to preach, you know? One really long sermon we call Hebrews. Somebody wrote it down. And then we've got 7 more letters, probably written by early church leaders named James and Peter and John and Jude. And then at the very end, there's this other book that's totally unlike all the others. It's written by John, and he's retelling a prophetic vision, almost like a dream or a trance, that he personally received from Jesus. Now, all of these writings are important. All of these writings are about Jesus' people and their faith. And it is truly incredible that we have access to such ancient documents from the very beginning of the history of our faith. But none of these, not a single one of these documents, is written as an instruction manual. None of these contain a list of steps for doing Christianity the right way, or for figuring out how to do church. In fact, I'm convinced that none of these authors, Paul, James, John, Peter, Jude, and even the unknown preacher in Hebrews, I'm convinced that none of these authors would have ever dreamed that world history was going to continue for as long as it has. I think they all believed that Jesus was going to come back centuries before now, and that Judgment Day would have already occurred by this point. I don't think these authors ever dreamed that Christians would be reading their letters 2,000 years later. And so when those 19th century pioneers on the American frontier decided to use their Bible as a guide for church life, they had some interpretive work to do. Now the easy part was going through and picking out the commands that they found in this section. They found consistent, repeated instructions for church activities that you would recognize today. Things like singing and taking communion and giving and sharing possessions. And so because they found consistent, repeated commands for those kinds of instructions, they made those a part of the life of their churches. But they also found that there were some church behaviors in the Bible that weren't commanded, but there were examples for us to follow. We were told about other churches that did this stuff. There's evidence in the book of Acts, this history book up here at the top, there's evidence there that the early church met on the first day of every week and that they shared the communion meal together at their meetings every week. It wasn't commanded, but the pattern was something that the more modern churches in the 1800s began to adopt because they saw the early church doing that. They found an example. But they definitely could not answer all of the questions about church based on the commands that they found and the examples that they found. And so the church leaders had to take another step. They had to start to make inferences based on their study. One illustration I can give you has to do with how the church handles baptism. The question came up in the church as to whether the church should baptize infants and small children. And that issue is not addressed in the scripture. That issue doesn't come up. But those 19th century frontier Christians inferred, based on the clues they could find, that since there were no examples of babies being baptized in the scriptures, and since all the examples of people in the scriptures being baptized specified that those people repented of their sin and confessed Jesus as Lord, it must mean that baptized people should be old enough to talk and old enough to decide for themselves. So that's the inference that they made. Now I know some of you are eating this stuff up. Some of you could have taught this lesson yourselves. And for some of you, this technical minutia about biblical interpretation is excruciatingly boring. But let me tell you about why this stuff matters. It's because the history of the church is riddled with cases where people studied the Bible looking for instructions for the church but ended up disagreeing with one another. The history of the church, the history of the global church, the history of our subsection, this movement of churches that got kicked off on the American frontier 200 years ago, and the history of the Heritage Church, our specific church, all of those histories feature story after story where people tried to study Acts through Revelation to find the instructions, but in the end, they couldn't agree about what they found. There have been disagreements about whether the commands that we found were relevant forever or whether they were just applicable to the first century church and its culture where it was originally written. There have been disagreements about whether the examples that we found of the church's behavior were just circumstantial or whether they were prescriptive and meant to be instructive for us for present day. There have been disagreements about the guidelines that we can infer from the numerous stories and the letters that we read. And many of these disagreements over the years have led to division between Christians in a movement that was started to promote Christian unity. And the catastrophic error, the fatal flaw in our thinking that led to all of that disagreement and led to a lot of hurt and led to a lot of division and led to the founding of new churches that set up shop right next door to one another was the assumption that you can read Acts through Revelation as an instruction manual for the church. Now, I've got a book that I use pretty regularly whenever I need to do some repairs on the family car. This is a Haynes manual for a Honda Pilot, model years 2003 through 2007. When you've got a family car with as many miles on it as mine does, you find yourself doing repairs pretty often. And I'm not a great mechanic, but I'm a cheap mechanic. And since I'm cheap, this book, which I think I bought used, comes in really handy for me. You see, in order to produce this book, they took a brand new Honda Pilot in mint condition, and they essentially disassembled and reassembled the entire thing. And they took pictures all along the way. And then they wrote up instructions for every repair job that they could come up with. Every repair job that they could imagine Brock Polk having to do on his Honda Pilot. And so last week, when I needed to repair or replace the power steering pump, I found detailed instructions ready to guide me through the process. Now, I still made mistakes. And it still took me 3 times longer than it would have taken a real mechanic to do that job. But thanks to this book, I got the job done. This thing is an instruction manual for anyone who wants to repair a Honda Pilot for these model years. You can borrow it if you want to. This is like having a set of blueprints from the manufacturer for building your car from the ground up. And for virtually every job that's described in this book, there's really only one right way to do it. I mean, you may have your own unique tools. You may have a different garage setup than I do. But if you're going to change out the power steering pump, there's really no way to get around removing the serpentine belt and the mounting bolts and the hose clamps. There's only one way to do it. But we make a mistake as Christians when we suppose that the Bible functions like a blueprint for the church. We make a mistake when we suppose that the Bible contains instructions or examples or inferences for every situation that the church will face. We make a mistake when we assume that there's really only one right way for the church to do God's will. We make a mistake when we assume that the pattern and the solutions and the strategies that the first century church followed to live out faith in their context are the same pattern and solutions and strategies that God expects us to follow as we live out faith in ours. And we make a mistake when we suggest that a permanent instruction book for the church is what the New Testament writers had in mind to begin with. If we are going to be intellectually honest, we have to admit that the New Testament writers were writing with specific agendas in a specific context to specific people. They were writing to subjects of oppressive governments who were following an outlawed faith that could lead to their arrest and persecution and assassination. In an age long before all of the technologies and the innovations and the discoveries and the inventions that you and I take for granted every day, the writers of the New Testament, especially the writers of Acts through Revelation, who personally lived out their faith in different ways depending on the context of their travels, were teaching in their writings, they were teaching their spiritual protégés how to be a Christian and how to be a church in Corinth and Rome and Thessalonica and Ephesus and Jerusalem. And we can gather some principles. And we should read this content. And we should devour this content. And we can use the wisdom of these Christians and the Christians for the last 2,000 years who have written about these Christians and the wisdom of our current spiritual family and spiritual leaders. And we can use the intellect that God has endowed in us. And we can lean on the power of the Holy Spirit to discern what these books mean for us. But Paul and James and Peter and Jude were not writing an instruction manual for how to do church in Fort Worth in 2019. What they did do, and what they did consistently, was point every church in Rome, Corinth and Ephesus and Philippi and Thessalonica. They pointed every single church back to the good news about Jesus. Every single time. This is how Paul explained it to the Philippians. Oh, he gave them some specific instructions. He addressed issues that were going on in their church. He gave them some advice. He referenced examples. He made inferences about how they should live. But he also said this. He said, whatever happens, no matter how it goes down, no matter how you're treated, no matter how the citizens of your city react to your faith, no matter how the person sitting next to you on the pew behaves or interprets what I have to say or applies my recommendations, whatever happens, he says, conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel of Christ. And then, when I come to you, or whether I come, whether I get to come see you or I just hear about you from miles away, I will know that you are standing firm in the one Spirit, striving together as one for the faith of the gospel. And he wrote it that way, and he said it in as many words in all these other letters, because that's the point. Because the point is to continue to live your lives in a manner that's worthy of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to let everybody else see you do it. I've got one more book I want to show you this morning. It's a book you may be familiar with from raising your children. It's called Where's Waldo? This is a fun book, because this book is full of some of the most congested, busy, crazy looking pictures you've ever seen. But somewhere in all of that mess, somewhere in all of that chaos going on in this page, there's this guy named Waldo. He wears a red and white striped shirt, a red and white striped toboggan hat, glasses, very recognizable. And your job is to search through all the other stuff and point to Waldo. And so, if you look at a picture of the action going on in a train station, boy, there's a lot going on there. People having problems, people having disagreements, people late for the train, people falling off the train, all kinds of crazy stuff. But your job is not to focus on all of that. Your job is to zoom in. To zoom in and point to Waldo. That's what you do. That's the point of this book, is to point to Waldo. And the interesting thing is that after you've discovered Waldo, after you've pointed to Waldo and shown your kid, or your kid has shown you where Waldo is, you turn the page. And suddenly, you're in an entirely different context. You're in a department store. And there's all kinds of chaos and craziness going on, and there's people trying on clothes, and there's people fighting over items, and there's people that can't find what they're looking for, and there's people that are trying to steal stuff, and there's people that are just doing every different kind of thing in this department store. But the point of the book, the point of the game, is not to focus on all that other stuff. The point is to zoom in and point to Waldo. Maybe you can make the connection yourself. But just in case, I'm going to spell it out. That as we search our way through this library. As we spend our time devouring the contents of this library, there are a lot of different things that we could focus on. A lot of different things that we could get fixated on and worry about and disagree about. And if you don't have pretty clear instructions about what this thing is for, it can cause a lot of distraction and a lot of problems. But those who were with Jesus, those who were related to Jesus, those who were visited by the post-resurrection Jesus, those who founded the earliest church, those who traveled the Mediterranean rim, subjected themselves to torture, shipwreck, persecution, ridicule, imprisonment, and eventually, for many of them, execution. They all told us the point of the library is to point to Jesus, to zoom in past all the other clutter, and to point to Jesus. And when they wrote to Christians in Philippi, where there were people sitting on the pew at opposite ends of the pew from one another, disagreeing with one another, and they couldn't work it out, Paul said, it's about living a life worthy of the gospel. And when he wrote to Titus, this young man trying to lead a church in a place where church was brand new and nobody knew what it was supposed to look like, he said, remember, in all this other stuff, he said, when the loving kindness of God appeared, it saved us. And that's what this stuff's all about. And I could give you example after example of how Peter and Jude and John and Luke and Mark and Matthew and even the unknown writers, the unknown authors, said the same thing over and over again. Because the point is not to focus so much on all of the extraneous, all the stuff that's going on around Jesus. The point is for us in our context, whether we're at the train station or the department store or work, the point is to point to Jesus. And in that way, the church's mission is the same as the Bible's mission. We're supposed to help people find Jesus in our context. And every context is a little different. But the good news is, in every context, Jesus is the same. And so we ought to be able to recognize him really easily. He'll be the one that's loving his neighbor. He'll be the one that's praying for his enemy. He'll be the one that's putting others first. He'll be the one that's serving when he shouldn't have to. He'll be the one that's washing feet. He'll be the one that's looking for the people out on the margins that don't expect to be noticed. He'll be the one that makes time for the people who are hurting when people of privilege are expecting him and waiting for him. He'll be the one who lays down his life for his friends. That's how we'll recognize it. That's how we'll show it. That's how we'll share it. And that's how God will change the world.